Yo, what's going on, guys? This is Chris Mead from the DTCX Exceptional E-Commerce Podcast. I'm here with my boy Nick Gein from Trough.
What's going on, brother? Thanks for having me.
Not too much, man. Thanks for joining us. Been a longtime fan of your guys' stuff. Dude, I literally just moved into my new apartment, and my mom saw all the Trough stuff you guys have sent me. And she's like, Chris, I just spent $60 at Whole Foods on this. Can I have a bottle? And she broke down almost crying, dude. It was pathetic.
That's hilarious.
It was amazing. She loves it, dude. We love it. I mean, it's been a game changer in our kitchen. Like, I'm sure you hear it all the time. But talk me through that process, right? Like, was it always – like, I didn't grow up wanting to play – like, sell volleyball nets, right? I was never – I didn't play volleyball a day in my life. I thought it was lame as hell. But we had a cool idea, and it was just fun to do at the beach. Like, how did the hot sauce stuff come?
Yeah, so real quick, actually, I was in Mexico this past weekend, and I was at a Four Seasons, and they had a CrossFit on the beach. So I was really stoked.
Let's go. Let's go. That's amazing.
Congrats on all your success, too. I've been loving seeing everything come to fruition and scale, et cetera. But yeah, you know, growing up, I've always had a knack for side hustles ever since I was young. You know, I remember when I was a kid, I was bugging my parents to set up garage sales and take shit out of the garage and just sell it to people that would come by and see the signs. I was the guy that was knocking on the neighbor's door, asking them if I can mow their lawn for $20 and then wash their car, et cetera. So, you know, I never knew that I was, you know, a quote unquote entrepreneur, but I kind of saw these patterns from a very young age that I think would eventually define my career as an entrepreneur, but it was something that I think was just in my blood. Grew up with an amazing family. They raised me very well, but I think there were certain times and things that I wanted that they weren't able to provide for me. And it made me want to go out there and get it myself. And I think that's truly what evolved me into kind of, okay, figuring things out along the way. How can I save up enough money to buy the mini bike? Or, you know, how could I move out of the house on my own and not have to worry about my parents paying my rent, et cetera. And, you know, slowly compounded over time.
That's awesome, dude. Yeah, same background here. Dude. Grew up on food stamps. I remember my dad lost his job when we were 16. We had to go, like, work to go pay the rent to keep the lights on. I used to be addicted to Guild Wars. I don't know if you know, like, World of Warcraft. And dude, they told me that the internet was going to be off, and I was bugging. I thought I was going to lose all my online friends. So I was like, yo, I'm going to work, like, 10 hours a day to make sure the Wi-Fi stays on. That was crazy.
That's epic.
No, but it teaches you that hustle, dude. Like, no matter how big you guys keep getting, but I'm sure it's just a crazy feeling to wake up and you still have that drive and passion, because every day it's like, you guys just launched What the Trough, crazy YouTube series. Like, I was so impressed with episode one. So congrats on that.
I appreciate it.
How did the hot sauce, like, I know you guys have the Instagram handle, right? But like, what made you think of, did you have this recipe? Was it a family recipe? Like, I know you don't want to get too proprietary, but like, talk to me about that.
You know, growing up in high school and college, I had a bunch of little side hustles. I met my savage co-founder, his name's also Nick Agiloni, in college. We met through mutual friends and we instantly hit it off because we both loved just talking about big ideas. He had a couple of businesses through college. One was a really cool powdered beverage lifestyle brand. I had a couple of things myself. One was like a D2C hat brand, as well as a couple other e-com related things. At the time, social media was really having a strong moment in respect to how brands were using these platforms to growth hack and create big communities and, you know, driving traffic to a website or a landing page to sell product. Yeah. And we both got very immersed to social media, Instagram specifically. And we really saw kind of the future and how this would be used for brands to continue growing and kind of using Instagram or whatever it might be as the home base where people would come and see what it is you're about, whether or not they fuck with you or not. They could just kind of look through your tiles, see the content you're putting out, et cetera. One of the little hustles that I had was scooping up these OG Instagram handle names. I had a handful of them and I got sauce organically. Didn't buy it. I just got it organically. And as soon as I got it, I hit up Nick. I was like, yo, I just got sauce on IG. This is pretty crazy. This is like Times Square of New York for IG.
It's crazy.
It's kind of the intersection of like food and pop culture. There's two meanings to it. Let's do something with it. And he was like completely on board right out the gate. So we started just growing this really cool lifestyle food account, things we thought would resonate well with a pop culture foodie. So like rappers with pizza and chicks with food and just really cool saucy content and food porn. And we grew the account to like 10 or 12,000 followers really quick. It got to the point where we were like, hey, this is cool having this account, but do we just want to be like a food blog on Instagram, or do we want to do something bigger? Do you want to create a brand out of this? Instantly, we're like, okay, let's create a product that we could kind of put behind this platform that we were building. It was obvious to us sauce was going to be kind of the lane we were going to stick to.
Of course.
We looked at the market, looked at like barbecue sauce and salad dressing and pasta sauce. And at the time, hot sauce was really becoming a thing in pop culture. Hoi Fong was having its moment. Sriracha, people were fucking with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, Beyonce was talking about
hot sauce. That was at the same time. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And we're like, okay, like hot sauce is dope. Looked at the category, massive opportunity. So we kind of dug a little bit deeper and we saw a ton of white space. You know, we didn't see any really dope lifestyle hot sauce brand that existed. Nobody was really going top shelf luxury. Everybody was like more middle craft.
Yeah, $3 to $5 price point.
Yep. Yeah, legacy, generational type brands. And nobody was really doing anything on social media or e-com. Everybody was just trying to get on the shelves in the grocery store, doing kind of like the old school playbook. So for us, we were like, shit, let's kind of go against what's ever been done in the category. Let's be the first top shelf Dom Perignon of hot sauce. Let's attach this kind of lifestyle to it, similar to what, you know, Ciroc did with vodka. Let's not try to rely on retailers. Let's just go direct to consumer. Let's take this e-com approach. You know, we decided that we were going to create a luxury hot sauce brand. And for us, we really wanted to create an amazing product that had great integrity. We wanted a flavor profile that had never been done before. So we looked at high-end ingredients like saffron, caviar, and truffle. Mm-hmm. We landed on truffle because truffle is also very relevant. You know, a lot of people started adopting truffle. Truffle fries and, you know, a lot of things in the culinary world were getting hot.
Yeah.
And we spent about 2 years developing the brand and the formula. We probably went through about 350 different recipes before
found one that,
this is it. And then we launched in December 2017 and we just went bananas. And now we're in our fifth year of business.
That's awesome, dude. Yeah, that's crazy. 350. I know so many people trying to make food brands and I've been working with this one company like as a mentor and they're like 9 recipes deep and they're starting to feel burnt out. But like that's just a testament. Like it takes a long ass time to get a perfect recipe down. And are you guys still making tweaks or like how now that you guys are like for us, right? We did 6 or 7 iterations of CrossNet before we had our good enough. It was good enough. That's what we called it. And then we would make modifications along the way. Are you guys still like tweaking the recipe as you go or is it kind of it's perfect now?
We've got it to the point where it's pretty refined.
Yeah.
But when we come out with different categories, like for example, we launched pasta sauce and we launched mayonnaise, we're continuing to refine the formula as well as we have with hot sauce.
Okay.
I would say hot sauce now, like that taste and the flavor profile, so many people have tasted already. We don't want to really
change it too much. Yeah.
Yeah, if you wouldn't change it too much, it really loses, I guess, the attributes that, you know, people really enjoyed their first experience. So it's at a really good spot right now.
No, it makes sense. So it's funny. I reached out to Nick A, your other co-founder, probably 2 years ago when we became friends. And the reason I reached out was we were e-commerce only. We started to diversify. We got into Dick's. We got into Walmart. We're in like 2,000 stores overnight. And my mind was just going crazy because our e-commerce sales were starting to tank. And our retail sales were going great. So it's like how you build out that attribution model. Do you wish you guys went – so I know you were talking about going against the grain, going D2C only. Do you wish you went into Target and all those stores sooner or how do you feel about your distribution rollout?
Actually, I think very, very proud of the patience that we had. Mm-hmm. Because what had happened is when you start telling a lot of these retailers no early on, they want you more, right? And
yep.
they start to see your brand more and more. They start to see your social media following grow. They start to see their friends and family posting about it and asking, hey, have you tried that Chuff brand? So we built a lot of leverage early on creating the largest condiments brand online first. And then what happened was we slowly started to say yes to select accounts, things that would help elevate the brand. So Neiman Marcus and Selfridges and really high-end luxury boutiques, mm-hmm. as well as small mom-and-pa gift shops and gourmet shops. And then from that point, we said, okay, let's go a little bit bigger. So that's when we did like Whole Foods of the world, Erewhon of the world. By holding back and not going into retail too early, by the time we did go into retail, people would see us in store and like, oh shit, that's the brand from whatever, or that's a brand I see online. So that connection that person had, the shopper in store, even if they didn't buy it from us digitally as an e-commerce brand, they already saw it. So it built some type of credibility. Mm-hmm. So our velocities in retail have just been like second to none. It's been crazy.
That's awesome. So talk to me about like, who's the team running that day to day in the beginning? Were you guys the ones making the sales to Neiman Marcus? Like, what's that team? For me, like, I have two sales folks. I have like a brand communications girl who like runs all the copy, makes the images beautiful. And then we have two graphic designers in house. Like, what's that retail team look like?
Yeah. So early on, some of these smaller accounts, it was pretty much Nick and myself, mostly Nick running sales and operations. Mm-hmm. And then as we got a little bit bigger, we hired another salesperson that was going to be continuing to knock down these doors. And then our first like really big hire on the sales team that was going to help us build out our sales team was a gentleman by the name of Reno, who is just an absolute savage, very experienced building out sales teams, an expert when it comes to understanding the retail landscape, the do's and don'ts, because there's a lot of like good damage you could do by going big into retail, but there's also a lot of things that you don't realize when you start working with distributors and you start learning about slotting fees and chargebacks that could really hit startup businesses hard from, you know, a cash perspective. So I think bringing in somebody that knew a lot more about this than us was extremely helpful in growing out our retail.
Yeah. Was there like a breaking point where you knew you had to hire this guy? Like when I think back to CrossNet, there were so many, we were getting killed in so many different ways where we were bleeding cash and stupid mistakes now, right? Like, was there an area where you were like, looking back, damn, we should have done this sooner?
So we were actually working with him before he was on our team full time. Okay. And he was kind of giving us advice and kind of steering us in the right direction. So by the time he did start, he would really hit the ground running. So I think the timing and perspective was good.
Okay.
But when I do look at other aspects of our business, that is one of the things that I have been very mindful of, learning from instances like this. You want to hire for the business you want in the future. And usually if you have a hiring need in the present, you probably, in most instances from a startup perspective, are already too late. And it's better to hire somebody that you might not necessarily need now, but you will be able to grow into over the next, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months. So by the time they're on board and getting ramped up and your business is continuing to grow, it's a more fluid momentum rather than kind of like slinky type of approach.
Absolutely. No, it makes sense. But how do you look at that then? Because in a perfect world, right, we're hiring 3, 6 month out candidates that are going to help lead our teams. But not everybody has the luxury to be a Truff or a CrossNet. And granted, you guys are even way bigger than we are. But like, you know, you're back in the early days. You got 4 employees. How do you hire that 5th and justify somebody who is not really going to be making that impact until 3 or 6 months down the road? Like, how do you look at that from a forecasting and planning and kind of think about that?
I think it's really important to have people on your team that truly share the same passion and the vision. A lot of the people that we hired were Truff customers, or they love Truff, or they really fuck with Truff. So we didn't ever want to try to like oversell on why somebody should come work for us. It's more of like, hey, this is what we're doing. We would love to have you on board. We think there's a ton of value we could be adding to your lifelong career perspective. But we also see a picture where you could come in and have the resources that you need, and we'll make sure to give you all the tools to be successful. Also, thinking of people that we have hired who we might have worked with for a period of time as a contractor, or maybe they worked at an agency and their current work environment wasn't where they wanted it to be. Those are great opportunities for us to kind of bring that relationship in-house and alleviated some of the risk of hiring some of these big people and not really knowing if they are legit or not. It's like, okay, we've been working with them already for 3 to 6 months. We know this is how they perform.
No, absolutely. That's a good point. For us too, like, our head of sales now was one of our first CrossNet customers ever. Some dude in Canada. I didn't even been to Canada at that point in my life. And he found CrossNet on the internet. He kept messaging us every month being like, I love CrossNet so much. Can I be a distributor? And I'm like, sure, you could buy 50. And he bought 50. And that was our biggest order like ever. It was like $4,500. And we stayed in touch forever. And it was time for a salesperson because I was doing all the stuff myself. And I didn't know what a slotting fee was. I didn't know what I could do at Dick's Sporting Goods and what I couldn't do, you know? So from a retail perspective, what are you guys doing now, like in-store marketing, right? Like, how are you helping drive units through? Because you're a digitally native first brand, but what else in the stores are you doing?
So a lot of our digital strategy helps support what we're doing in retail. So, okay. You know, we'll make a lot of really cool individual content pieces for any retailer, usually if it's like a very well-known retailer or somebody that is well-known from a national perspective, we'll announce on social media and we'll put a little bit of our own resource to help drive that initial trial. And then in store, you know, working with merchandising teams, working with third party kind of in the trenches, people that are going to the store, making sure the bottles are looking great, getting secondary displays, and really just like trying to hustle in store as much as we are out of the store, and trying to find like creative ways to work with our retailers.
It's like, so tough, dude. It's so tough.
We have the, like, we're a food, so it's easier for us to go create like a sandwich with the food service department, or we can merchandise our hot sauce with pizza, right? We try to get very creative with kind of how we play around with our in-store marketing approach.
No, I love it. You guys are crushing it. And like I love the out-of-home thing you guys did. I think it was a steak sandwich, right? Who has the best fillings, yeah, right?
Philly cheesesteak.
Are you guys going to do more out-of-home this year? Or how are you thinking about it? Because most of us, right, we're, I don't know how old you are, but let's call it late 20s, early 30s, like, a lot of us think of, hey, out-of-home's dead. Like, that's for the old dudes. Nobody's doing that anymore. Is that still a part of your strategy going into this year?
Yeah. So, you know, we try to test a lot of things. We want to test everything and kind of use data to drive our forward-thinking decisions.
Yeah.
The out-of-home thing for us, that's definitely going to be a recurring pattern of content and campaign that people will see. We found that there's a lot of value that could be invested into brand that doesn't necessarily attribute a direct revenue or anything we could really like track through, you know, reporting.
It's just it's a feel good thing. You feel good about it. You know, it's doing the right thing to get your brand to the next step.
Yeah. And it makes it a little more real when you kind of do these in real life things.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, when they're so used to seeing you on Instagram or TikTok or Facebook, they see you outside, they're like, oh shit. Like, they kind of make that connection.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And you guys did that one around a trade show too, right? Have you been hitting up a lot of trade shows recently?
Yeah, that was during the Expo East in Philadelphia. So we'll be at Expo West coming up. We just did the Fancy Food Show in Vegas. And yeah, we're going to be continuing to knock those down.
I love it. Now, so we're coming up on time here. What's one thing you tell yourself like 2 years ago? You're starting a new company. You're starting a new food and bev company. You're just an e-commerce company right now. iOS has destroyed a lot of companies. Well, how would you do things differently? Like, piece of advice for your younger self.
It would be taking bigger bets earlier when I think they could pay off a lot more. And I'll give you a great example. We invested a ton of money into podcasts.
Yep.
When you look at all these different stages of acquisition and media buys across different channels, you know, social media, TV, podcast, out of home, etc. I think there's like a certain window of opportunity that will provide the best ROI. And what happens is a lot of people, they're kind of scared to jump in on those early stages and they want to see what happens when it plays out, right?
Yep.
Then what happens is once that window kind of gets towards the end, all of the late people kind of come in and start testing it. And by then it's like too late. So for us, like I wish we would have tested things a little bit earlier when it comes to stuff like, you know, podcasts and TV. And you don't need to allocate a huge amount of money to these things. It's more of just enough money that enables you to make a decision on whether or not you should continue investing into those.
Makes sense. And for a brand like you guys, you kind of have to wait a few weeks at least until you get to sell through at retail, right? Because you're not getting those reports daily. You're getting them weekly or monthly. So it's a little bit of a window, correct?
Yeah, there's definitely lag time, and patience is definitely important.
Speaking of patience, my last question, actually. How long have you guys been holding on to the idea of the oils and the sauces, right? Like, as an entrepreneur, you're probably cooking up the next 5 years of products and stuff you want to do. But like, how long did you keep that at home until it was ready to release?
So I guess from the beginning, Nick and I, we always thought about creating a brand that had one bold stroke. We didn't want to be the brand that kind of came out of the gate and tried to create this platform that had 17 different things we were trying to sell people. We wanted to be known as like the truff, right? Truffle hot sauce. That's it. And then small iterations off of that. So we'll never be a brand that has 10, 15, 16, 17 SKUs. Want to keep things very tight, similar to, you know, like Red Bull or Tabasco or some of these other legacy household names. But when there are certain areas of opportunity that enable us to not only create amazing products, but listen to our customers for what they want, it's a no-brainer for us. And I think you see that with, you know, the pasta sauce, the mayo, and the truffle oil.
Makes sense. That complete sense. It's tough to execute patience when you know you have these good ideas that could bring in so much money. And you guys definitely 100%. Did it the right way. All right. Appreciate if I could it. Have one more for if you could put one person on this podcast, who should I interview?
Steven Borelli from Cuts.
Let's get him on. I'm actually wearing a Cuts shirt right now. No, that's crazy. Let's set it up. All right, brother. I appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much, dude, for taking your time. Like, you guys are an influence to so many of us in the e-commerce world, and keep doing it good, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, brother.
Appreciate it, dude. So that's another episode of My Biggest Lessons. Each and every week, I'll be having one of my favorite entrepreneurs come on, share their stories, their mistakes, the things they wish they knew. Entrepreneurship's a lonely road, right? You only learn by getting better. You only learn by making mistakes. So I want them to come on and share their stories. If you have somebody in mind that you want on, drop a comment, subscribe, share with a friend. Let's get the best people in the world on here. Thanks for listening.